Hello.
Hello.
Hi, folks. Just wanted to let you know, this is one of the beta tests that we're doing. It's an idea I have in regards to a movie discussion or theory. I don't want to take away from the YouTube channel, Film Theory, so it's, call it Mafia, Long Coat Mafia Film, I don't know. I'll let you, the fans, decide. As we go, as we grow, to do it, we're going to do two movies in this beta episode. First one is Holes, fair warning for both movies. First one is Holes, the other one is going to be John Wick. Holes is a late 90s film would love to believe. Let's see. Pull up IMDb. Loading. Holes is a 2003 film. It stars Patricia Arquette, Sigourney Weaver, Shia LaBeouf, amongst others. It's a Disney film, for one thing. Let me give you a rundown of the story. Again, heavy spoilers in regards to the story. Basically, it entwines two stories. One is Shia LaBeouf's character, who will go on in and out as Stanley Yelnats, and Sigourney Weaver's character, a.k.a. Warden Walker. The story takes place in Texas. It ties the Warden's character and the Warden and Stanley's families together. The rundown is Stanley's backstory, their family's backstory is thus. Basically, his great-great-grandfather, Stanley the First, I think it is, or the father of Stanley the First, because the Stanley we see in the movie is Stanley the Fourth. So, his ancestor's backstory is he has a crush on one of the girls in the village. They don't say which country, so I'm going to go Italian, maybe, I don't know, Italian-Hungarian type of deal, in and around there. He has a crush on this hot-ass chick in town, and him being a young man and kind of smart, he asks the local gypsy, Madame Zeroni, for advice. She says, you know what, forget the girl, go to America. My son's in America. It's a land. The whole thing takes a hunt. First off, the whole thing, whole movie backstory takes place about 150 or so years ago, give or take 10, 20 years. So, she says, go to America and find your fortune, find your love there. And he kind of ignores this and asks. Now, here's the thing. I don't know how Disney, people didn't yell at Disney for this. I guess they gave Disney a lot of rope, a lot of leeway, because in this, Stanley the First goes to his crush's father and asks, hey, I want to marry your daughter. And the father goes, you know what? this other guy here is offering his fattest pig, his prize pig, for my daughter. And the guy that's standing there, when the father points to, actually, he points to this guy and says, you know, this other guy, and says, he offered the pig, this prize, his heaviest pig. The dude that he points to, it looks about 40, 50 years old, and he's like 260, 300 pounds, and full-on creeper. He is that creeper. But the father says, what do you have to offer besides, this guy's offering me a pig. What do you have to offer me for my daughter? And the guy says, I have love for my daughter. In essence, I have love, a heart full of love, and I'm willing to work, provide for your daughter. And the guy just laughs him off. The father just laughs him off. And what I said, that I'm surprised a lot of women's groups didn't yell at this, is because the whole aspect of a father selling his daughter, which is completely fucked up. Stanley the First goes back to the gypsy, and the gypsy basically tells Stanley the First, the chick's dad is a schmuck. Literally, he tells him a schmuck. And she says, listen, take that pig. She points to one of the pigs that she has. Take that smallest pig that I have. Carry the pig up the mountain. Have it drink and eat up there. And as the pig grows, you'll grow stronger too. And he's kind of defiant about this. And she pretty much tells him, shut up. Take the pig. Take him up the mountain. While you're doing this, sing this little ditty and carry him back down. But the thing is, he says, part of this deal is, in order for you to pay me back for the pig, is that once you offer the pig to your crush's father and give that pig to him, you come back to me, you carry me up the mountain, and you sing the song while I drink and eat up there, and I grow stronger. And then, after this whole montage type deal of him carrying up the pig and the pig growing, he brings the pig to the father, and it's, decision time. And the father says, you know what, I'm going to have my daughter decide on this. And this, I'm not one to bash a woman, but this is one airheaded motherfucking bitch. Because first she says, I get to decide. Yeah, you can go. You're my daughter. Decide. First she's hemming. She's hawing. And she, which one's bigger? The father pretty much says, the same size. She then asks, which one's heavier? And the father pretty much says, they look the same weight to me. And she's looking at the creeper, which is literally drooling over her. And she looks over to Stanley the First, and he's literally there. Nice Sunday best, let's put it like that. Nice suit, his hair is combed, it's all slicked back. He looks nice. I mean, he looks nice, spiffy, clean. He even has a bouquet of flowers. And she goes, I don't know. You know what, well, I'm going to choose some number from one to, like, she's making up excuses to not choose, but she's like, she's kind of hemming towards the creeper a little bit. So Stanley pretty much says, fuck this, fuck you, fuck, tells the father, fuck you, keep the pig as a wedding motherfucking gift. I'm going to America, fuck yeah. And he goes up and he literally forgets about the promise he made to the gypsy, Madame Zeroni. At some point, now when he's older, and when he's doing the whole pig, he might be in his early 20s, maybe 21-ish, 20, 21, because he looks really young. And when he finally meets this outlaw, Kissing Kate, we'll go into her backstory in a little bit. When he finally meets Kissing Kate, she takes all his. He looks about in his 40s, maybe. Yeah, he looks maybe in his mid 40s. She takes all his stuff, leaves him to die, and in the desert, in the Texas desert, for 16 days, no food, no water. The young Stanley, Stanley the Fourth, says, "You know, how did he survive for 16 days with no food and water?" Well, the grandfather, Stanley the Second, says, "Well, he stayed on God's thumb, which had water and there was food up there." But when they found Stanley the First, he was kind of off center. Mind you. You find out later, God's Thumb, this mountain, is right near the camp that Stanley the Fourth is sent to. The warden's backstory is that her grandfather, Trout Walker, is a was a rich person in essence in this timeline in the late 1800s. Pretty much they owned where this desert spot is. There was this big 2-3 mile lake, and he owned Trout Walker's dad, and in essence, eventually him owned the lake and a little bit of the surrounding land around it and half the town that was nearby. And the thing about Trout Walker is that as a person of the money and that. And this whole aspect is that when he tries to seems to woo women, and it's like his major pickup line is, "I got a motherfucking motorboat, a steamboat, a little steam motorboat." But it the bat her the warden's backstory is more so kissing Kate Barlington or Catherine Barlington. The thing is, as a Kate has somewhat of a crush. Catherine, as she is in the early on in the flashbacks, she has a crush on Sam. Sam is the only token black guy in town. He's the only token black guy, but the town seems to, think he's okay because Sam's not doing anything wrong. He's got a farm somewhere, an onion farm somewhere on the other side of the lake, that he's growing onions, and he's kind of this weird snake oil salesman because he sells a lot of onion-based products and says, "Oh, the onions are good for your soul. They'll grow your hair. They might make your breath stink, but they're good for you. Have this onion concoction." And he, not only that, is he seems like a town handyman too. Like, I'm willing to do that. So Catherine has a crush on Sam, but Trout Walker has a crush on Catherine. But the thing is, Catherine and Sam fall in love. The one thing a lot of people have to understand, a white woman, a Caucasian white woman, and a African American man, especially a possible former slave in Texas during the late 1800s was, a relationship, a loving relationship was a big stinking no. It's something that was a taboo even in the 1960s. It's not so much of a taboo today. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but back in the time that this flashback between Catherine and Sam. It was extreme taboo, and they're in essence falling in love. He's doing chores because Catherine's a school teacher, and there's the schoolhouse is run down. He's fixing up the schoolhouse for the jam that Catherine makes, and she's also teaching him how to read and how to, do basic math and so forth and so on, which ain't. For the whole deal, job set that Sam's doing, it's a good deal, but they fall in love. Again, no problem. But at some point, Catherine and Sam kiss. And Trout Walker, the Warden's grandfather, see them kiss, and he has a big problem with this. A real big, big problem. And the thing is, Trout Walker gets a posse together, a bunch of people together, burn the church down, and they go after Sam and kill Sam. The sheriff pretty much tells Catherine, hey, it's not illegal for a white woman to kiss a black man or any man she chooses. It's a problem for a black man to kiss a white woman. Again, late 1800s, where this is not a good idea for an interracial couple to do. And the sheriff pretty much says, why don't you give me a kiss? She goes outside, hears the gunshot, and sees the boat with Sam. You know, she puts two and two together and realizes that Sam has been shot and he's dead, and Trout's the culprit. So the next day, she goes in to the sheriff's office, gung-ho on being an outlaw, and she changes her name to Kate, and she tells the sheriff, hey, sheriff, you still want that kiss? And he goes, yeah, sure, I'll take the kiss. Kisses the sheriff, leaves a lipstick mark of the kiss, and then kills the sheriff, thus becoming an outlaw. And she goes on this whole gung-ho robbing, killing spree, and she tells Stanley the Fourth's mom, says, if kissing Kate didn't leave their father alive, if she kissed him, therefore there would be no Yelnats family, there would be no him. But kissing Kate, after many years, she gives up the ghost, and I won't say gives up the ghost, but the lake dries out. She has buried the loot somewhere in that area, and Trout Walker is looking for her buried loot, and Trout Walker and his wife find Kate worn out by Sam's old boat, in essence, and they ask her, you know, where'd you bury the loot? And she says, you know what, I'm tired, I don't want to do this anymore, I'm not going to tell you where I buried the loot, I'm not going to give you the satisfaction. And she tells Walker that the lake dried up because there's no justice here. You didn't give, you know, because of your actions, that's why it up. And until everything's solved and there is justice between for what you did, and you finally get your family does get justice, there'll be no rain and no nothing. And she grabs like a poisonous lizard that's there and has that lizard bite her, and she dies. But to go back to Stanley's backstory, the gypsy, Madame Zeroni, says with her curse was that if Stanley the First didn't complete the bargain, there will be a curse on the Yelnats family, staying bad luck until he, in essence, does what he needs to do. So everything that happens to the Yelnats family, it's the no good grandfather, great grandfather, it's the curse that's on the family. So there's two curses going on here. One is the Yelnats curse, another one is the Walker curse. But the main story that's kind of intertwining them both is that Stanley the Fourth is just walking, minding his own business, and a pair of shoes drop on him. Pair of very good cleats drop on him, so he just picks them up, you know, walks off, and cops immediately swarm on him, asking him, guns are drawn, where'd you get the shoes, you know, and the They bring him back home. They don't have, the Yelnats family doesn't have enough cash for a lawyer. IMDb message boards have said, why didn't they get a public defender? Where's the public defender? But the thing is, what many people don't realize is that if you make above a certain amount, in most states, the public defender will not be able to defend you, because even though you're making enough for rent, food, caring for youth and all that, meaning if you have kids, you're able to care for the kids, that they have a shirts, clothing, food, that even though you're, in essence, have no extra money, in essence, what's coming in is going straight back out, they don't see that. They just see that you're making X amount of money, therefore you are making too much for a public defender. So, either way, that's one major problem that seems to happen, because the trial is just glossed over. And the judge gives Stanley a choice. He said, listen, I could put you in jail right here, right now, but there's this opening at this camp where you could learn your lesson, so to speak, and you have a choice, jail time or this camp. So Stanley says, all right, I've never been to camp. I'll go to camp. But the thing is, when you see the camp, the camp is called Camp Green Lake. And when they finally switch over to that camp, you could see violations in this camp from the start. Seems like there's no teachers, no nothing, just some minor guards where there's very few guards, and the one main person in charge called Mr. Sir, that's his name, Mr. Sir, how original, says that you could run off. There's the nearest town is like 15, 20 miles away, and by the time you get there, you'd be, in essence, dead of thirst. The heat will get you, heat exhaustion. And they're always showing that, you know, they're willing to, you know, risk the kids. Now, mind you, what they're doing with the kids is the kids are supposed to be digging holes. Looking, in essence, the camp, the warden's looking for the treasure, and she's masking the kids digging holes as a form of rehabilitation. But the thing is, there's no guards. They're risking there are camps like this for adults in some southern states where they chop down trees, they do road work, they farm, and there are state guidelines in place where even though these people are prisoners, there's no violations in reference to human rights. But when it comes to kids that are, or juveniles, where the youngest seems to be zero at maybe about 7 years old, and the oldest seems to be 15 or 16, they're still juveniles. You have to deal with the aspect of proper nutrition, water, make sure these kids are okay, proper medical care. But none of that seems to be present, so you're getting red flags right away. And they don't really know. There's problems with Stanley as well, but Stanley starts to make connection with the group of kids that he's with in the housed in camp. One of the things he does, he meets up with this character, this little, again, 7, 8-year-old kid named Zero. Everybody seems to have a nickname. Zero, you find out, can't read. A lot of people call him Zero because they think he's stupid, has zero intelligence. There's nothing going on in his head. All he's good for is digging holes. He really likes to dig holes. So Zero makes a deal with Stan saying, I hope you dig your holes. You teach me to read. Which all in all is a good, you know, a good deal. But after a while, Zero tells Stanley that, you know, my name ain't Zero. My real name is Zeroni. But the thing is, you gather from the start of the film that Stanley, throughout his life, is being told this family history over and over again that about Madame Zeroni, his great aunt, his ancestor, who came to America. But he doesn't put two and two together to realize that Zero is the gypsy's, great 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 descendant here, and he doesn't seem to put that together. But at one point, everything starts to go fishy. You finally realize something's fishy when the warden comes out for one thing or another, and she, the other kids in the tent that Zero and Stanley hang out with and dig holes with, they complain to the warden saying, well, Stanley doesn't dig his hole completely. He does maybe a half, maybe two-thirds of the hole, and Zero helps him. And they, instead of griping to why he doesn't dig the hole, he's not digging, he's not learning his lesson, why he's doing that, and Stanley says, well, I'm helping him teach, learn to read. And both him, both the warden, Mr. Sir, and the counselor, the only counselor, dig into Stanley for teaching, trying to teach Zero to read. And this is where you get the fact that these kids are not getting any education whatsoever, which is probably a must in 90% of all the states, especially in Texas. She tells him, listen, you can't teach Zero anything. You can't teach him how to read. He asks her pretty much why. And she says, because I said so. So, which is, and she also tells, implies that these kids are just slave labor. That's it. And, but, therefore, because the incident is, I have in my notes that it's due to a fight, and because after the whole thing, Zero runs off. He just, he just runs. And the warden, here's the second fishy thing. The warden just says, let Zero run. We don't care about the kids. Don't worry about it. But back at camp, while they're packing up Zero's stuff, she tells both Mr. Sir and the doc that, since Zero has no family, delete his records in the camp and try to hack into state records and delete his files there, because no one cares about Zero. But somehow Stan comes in and says, I care, I heard all this. And but over the next day or two, Stanley and the group, the tent group is group Troop D, because they kind of a little bit care about Zero a little bit. And so Stan comes up with a little bit of a plan, takes the water truck for a joyride, and just, maybe not even a quarter of a mile joyride, then runs off. The warden comes out and says, what are we going to do? Mr. Sir asks, is the one that asks that, says, what are we going to do? Because he has family. Stanley has family. So the warden says, we'll wait 2 weeks to report him missing, and by the time the feds come up to look for him officially, he'll be dead. He'll get lost. He'll be lost. He'll be picked clean. He'll be dead. So don't worry too much about that. Stan eventually finds Zero. Ironically, in the old boat, which is still, well, it's, some people might ask, how is the boat still together? Well, it is a desert environment. There's no rain, so a boat like that would be very, even though probably brittle, it'll still be intact, a little bit weather-worn. But after Zero and Stan getting reacquainted and finding the fermented old peaches in this boat. Why neither of them got sick, right? Especially Zero, right off the bat, is beyond me. Stan spots God's thumb and tells Stanley that, hey, I think my ancestor managed to survive. That's where my ancestors survived for 16 days. Let's go to God's thumb and see if we can survive there. Now, God's thumb is, in essence, a sheer cliff. And at some point, Zero gets injured and is his hands get cut. And finally, he says, I don't feel so good. My stomach is hurting. I think it's, well, some of the stuff that we had in the boat. It's coming, I had more of it. You only had a little bit, So, in a way, Stan fulfills his ancestor's promise by carrying Zero to the top of, in essence, a mountain. And when they find the spring and the onions that are still growing there, he feeds Zero, in essence, has a Zeroni become stronger in this area. Well, he sings the song, so forth and so on, when they get up there. So, therefore, in doing this, the curse is lifted in a span of 3 days. During this, you see that the curse is lifted. The father finally finds a cure for foot odor. And they lawyer up. They finally get a lawyer. They're probably willing to do it for pro bono or close to it, or what have you. And she goes to get, it's like, hey, she goes to the camp to get Stanley out, and the warden says, well, come back with court order, then I'll give you Stanley. And that's when they realize that the warden and Mr. Sir and the doctor realize they're in deep fucking shit. And they said, well, we'll just move the plan up to say he ran off. Oh, after he found out that he was free. But they make a plan story saying, hey, it was before she showed up and I didn't find no whatever. But within a day or two, the lawyer comes back. But during that meantime, Zero, Stan has an idea on the way back down, saying, hey, I think the treasure might be, there's something buried in one of the holes that I did when I got here within the first 2 weeks. I want to dig in that hole a little bit more. And they go back to that hole and they start digging. Meanwhile, the lawyer and a couple of Texas officials show up the next day while they're the Stan and Zero digging in this hole with the court order. But Stan and Zero find a trunk, a decent sized trunk, that has Stanley Yelnats written on it, on a plaque. But the warden comes up and says, hey, you found what I've been looking for all my life since my grandfather took me out here long ago looking for the stupid treasure. That's mine. And that's when the lawyer shows up and the Texas Rangers. Now, here's what happens. And the main official from the state finds some violations off the from the get-go. And the other thing that's found out is that, hey, the lawyer, Stanley's lawyer says, hey, Stanley, let's go. Put your trunk in the car. Let's go. Grab your other stuff. All the while, the warden saying, hey, that trunk is mine. It's mine. It's my property. It was found on my property. It's mine. Yada, yada, yada. Yeah, mine, mine, mine. The trunk is mine. The trunk is mine. And but Stanley's like, you know what? I'm not going to leave here and leave Zero behind. Zero's real name is Hector Zeroni. I'm not leaving Hector here. And so the lawyer says, fine, get me Hector's records. And that's when they find out that Hector's records, they don't There are no Hector's records. You mean Hector's not on file. So, Hector, you know, let's go. But that's when there's other things come to light that Mr. Sir is on probation and that he hasn't kept up with his probation. And he's carrying, because he's on probation, he has an illegal handgun. Or the handgun's not really illegal, it's illegal for him to have it. So therefore, he gets arrested. And he admits, trying to save his own ass, is that he says, hey, she hired a doctor that's not a doctor. He's falsifying records. So the doc is, because even to be a social worker, you need a state license, and this is across the board from Maine to California. It's mainly for insurance purposes and to heavy fines and the whole deal. So therefore, the doc gets arrested, and because of all these violations right off the bat, the warden gets arrested, and the Maine Texas official says, "Hey, this whole camp is now under our jurisdiction." So that's where the main thing here is takes place in reference to IMDb. IMDb says the trunk, in essence, even though it has Stanley's name on it, it belongs to the warden because it's found on her property. I don't think so. Personally, I don't think so. Because even though it's found on her property, correct, and it was found on before the jurisdiction was transferred to the state, now the family has a lawyer. Not to mention, he was found, there was probably a whole shit ton of mistakes that the state made in the whole trial. That, meaning he didn't get proper representation, so forth and so on, didn't get a proper trial because he didn't have a lawyer. So, now that he has a lawyer, the family could have said, listen, you let us have the trunk, you wipe Hector's, you know, record clean, you wipe Stanley the Fourth's record clean, we'll call it even, we'll settle out of court. So, a lot of times, especially since towards the end, they open up the trunk and find all the millions upon millions of dollars, or what's worth millions of dollars in the trunk. So it's better off on them saying, hey, let's keep the trunk, not press it. Hey, we won't file a lawsuit for millions upon millions of dollars against the state and this camp for all the violations, the wrongful jail time, so forth and so on. We'll just keep the trunk, we'll call it even. So I think most lawyers and most judges would say, hey, sure, why not? Let's call it even. You keep the trunk, and if there's anything of value in the trunk, just make sure if you sell it, pay your taxes. And I'm sure that's what they did. And in the trunk, they find some AT&T stock, which I don't think was called AT&T in the late 1800s. But they show at least two certificates worth $25,000. And Stanley says, I want to give half what's in this trunk to my friend Hector. Hector Zeroni. And that's when at the end, as soon as hearing the name Hector Zeroni, the grandfather is the one that says, did you say his name was Hector Zeroni? And Hector is the one like, yep, that's my name. Don't wear it. In essence, that's my name. Don't wear it out. He goes, let him have half. It's, in a way, the grandfather saying, you know, yeah, you broke the curse, you know. Let him pay restitution. Let him have half. But you have to figure $25,000 in stock. For a company like AT&T or Ma Bell, that point, it split and splitting and splitting and splitting. It might have been about $2.5 million worth today, so if not more. Plus, there was gold found in there, so you have to aspect that there, you know, either way, both families came away with at least $2 to $3 million after taxes. But, and there's a happy ending in all this. So, The thing is, you know, with it, that the grandfather makes, you know, the connection first time, yet the son, probably hearing the story all his life, doesn't put two and two together. But either way, it's a fun little film. I touch base with it at least once every few years, at least once a year. I'd say it gets a hard six out of me. The next one we're going to do is John Wick. This is a more recent film. It came out last year. Late last year, early this year. It's a good movie. Again, heavy spoilers. It's a Keanu Reeves movie. Before you say, "Oh man, it's a Keanu Reeves movie," we're going to hear, "Whoa." He doesn't, ironically, he doesn't do the whole surfer dude type deal in this. It's a very good mob type film, vengeance type film. Heavy spoilers. The story is basically this, and it's all, the movie's about an hour and 40 minutes, hour and 45 minutes long. And you find out basic what happens in the first 10-15 minutes of the movie. And basically, it kind of starts towards the end of the movie. The first minute or so shows what's going to happen at the end. But as soon as that happens, it flashes back to the what did happen and goes on. So it does come for full circle. What happens is, you see Keanu Reeves, a.k.a. John Wick, meeting up with this, what becomes his wife, and they're on this date. From what you gather, it's either her birthday or her their anniversary. Either one, there's a lot of room for backstory movies in this. For this movie. And from what IMDb has stated, that there's two more in the works. So hopefully one of them is a prequel, and we'll get more backstory, which opens, this movie is rhyme for theories like what I'm about to discuss. But back to the basic storyline is that on this date night, or this anniversary, his wife, his female friend, it turns out to be his wife, collapses. And she's taken to the hospital, and she turns out she, because of certain scenes, that she probably has cancer. She's very ill. And she died because of what she has, she dies. At the funeral, you'll see, the character, you find out his name is Marcus, shows up, gives his condolences. More on Marcus in a minute. He gives us the condolences, tells John that it's been several years, that there are, you know, he kind of puts it there, in our line of work, there's only days like this are scattered, but either way, that night after the wake, there's a knock on John's door, and it's a delivery. And John accepts the delivery, and the delivery turns out to be this beagle. I mean, oh, dear God, this dog is adorable. It's a, I'm going to say a eight-week-old beagle puppy. Turns out the beagle's female, and her name is Daisy. I mean, this dog is adorable. Despite being your heart being pulled out of you, the tears being pulled out because you see how well John has cared for his wife, or how he felt for his wife, and there's a little card taped to the dog carrier, and he reads the card, and he said, the voice that's overheard from what the card says is from his wife, saying, "Hey, this is a card, is just a card," paraphrase what she says, "Don't worry about this card. It's, you loved me, we were the best of friends, you were at, in essence, you were at your best when you cared for me, I know you loved me, but what I want you to do is love this dog and care for this dog like you would me," meaning like, hey, treat this dog like you would me, and he opens the dog carrier, takes out this little beagle puppy, looks at it and breaks down. Literally, he breaks down. And because here's this greatest gift his wife gave to him after death. And you could tell that John Wick doesn't know what to do with this dog anyway. But he's willing to learn because his wife says so. And he goes, all right. Next morning he gets up, takes the dog out. Dog comes back and says, I guess I need to get you some kibble. Now, you're talking about a man that's literally willing. He goes, when they finally go out, he gets dressed and goes out. The dog follows him out to his car, which is a 69, see, I wrote it down, a 69 Mustang Boss 429. This is a purebred American muscle car. And it is cherry mint. They go out, but the dog runs out. We're talking about a puppy that runs out like Bilbo Baggins going on an adventure. Literally, you read the look on the dog's face like, I'm going on an adventure. And literally, that's what happens. Because when they cut to the return trip, for a gas fill up, you see in the back part of the whole back seat is filled with dog beds, looks like a dog bed, dog food, toys up the yang-lang. You know, just out the ass of toys for this dog. And, like, he didn't know what to get, so I'm getting everything. There's going to be no expense for this dog. So, and you can't blame John Wick whatsoever for, you know, going full tilt bozo for his, you know, new friend. But while at the gas station filling up, another car rolls in, it's filled with Russians. And the area you get is immediately, it's mob. It's Russian mob. It's not just Russians. We're going on a trip to New York City for the day, you know. We're visiting family. But it is Russian mob. But you get that, and one of them comes up to John Wick and asks about the car. He said, that's a Mustang 429 Boss. You know, Boss 429. And sweet. And John pretty much says thank you. And the guy says, how much is it? How much are you selling it for? So John says, it's not for sale. I'm not selling the car. And in essence, in Russian, the dude says, everything has a price, bitch. And John turns around and replies back in Russian, saying, the bitch ain't for sale. And pretty much the guy gets insulted and cut back to later that evening. And the dog pretty much wakes up, barks, and just goes to run downstairs. John thinking that, you know, new dog owner, hey, you gotta go, literally says, hey, do you gotta go again or something like that, you know, and follows the dog downstairs. And when he turns on the light, there are three people in his house, and they attack him. You find out that one of the attackers is the dude from the gas station, and they beat him up, kick the dog, and hurt the dog. They don't show what happened to the dog, but all you think is that they killed or did something bad to the dog, and which is, you know, really, I mean, that scene was hard. As a dog lover myself, that scene was really hard to watch. It was hard to watch, you know, that aspect of them hurting this puppy, this literally harmless puppy. And you wake up to, it cuts to John waking up, and you see this trail of blood leading up to the dog right by John Wick. Like, the dog crawled to John Wick and died right up next to him. And it's like, dear God, them feels, man. You know, it's like, man, the dog had enough strength left as a puppy to, you know, crawl up to its master and literally, you know, cuddle up, and John just breaks down again. Talk about, you know, he has his car stolen twice. I mean, it's fucked up royally. You have to feel for him because he starts to get pissed. The rest of the movie is how they prove, you know, it's not just John Wick kicking ass. The movie goes on to prove that John Wick is a badass, you know, and he's a man to be fucking respected and feared. One of which that you start out by seeing the mobsters take the car to a chop shop, which is the owner is played by John Leguizamo, Illyrio. But before we go into John Leguizamo's character, I'm gonna go into William Dafoe's character for a moment, Marcus, because the film doesn't go into any backstory, which is a other than the whole wife and the wife dying, is perfect. Literally, it's perfect. It leaves a lot open. This is why William Dafoe's character Marcus, it doesn't go into it, kind of hints, and there's a lot of evidence that Marcus was an old friend or John's mentor, and there was a lot of respect between the two. But I'm willing to go out on a limb saying that he was his that Marcus is his stepfather. Because you don't, again, there's no backstory between the two, just that the evidence is that they're friends. That the whole aspect of that is like, hey, you could almost see the aspect of the stepfather that he didn't approve, because both of them were hitmen. He didn't approve his daughter dating and marrying a hitman, so he either disowned his daughter. But still, because he had respect for John Wick, a deep respect, that he saw him as a friend, and there's kind of like he cares for John Wick, kind of cares for Marcus. So it's open both ways. I want to see that backstory in one of the sequels or as a prequel. But as I was saying, the one proof that John is a badass or goes to a badass when they take the car to John's Leguizamo's chop shop. They won't. John won't touch it. Leguizamo won't touch it. When they ask, you know, John why, he's like, "I ain't touching it. I don't have to tell you anything. I don't care if you're the mob boss's son. I ain't telling you shit." And not to mention, he decks the mob boss's son. And later that day, the mob boss calls John Leguizamo, and he goes, "I understand you struck my son." And he said, "Yeah, I did. It's because you brought in a car." And he said, "You struck my son because you brought in a stolen car? Well, you know, why?" You know, it's like, that's stupid. "You struck my son." And that's when Leguizamo says, "It's not the car, it's who the car belonged to." And he said, "All right, who did the car belong to?" And he said, "It belonged to John Wick." And that's when the only thing you hear from the mob boss is, "Oh, click." Which means John Leguizamo's character is just, you know, off the hook. And in a lot of ways, other things that they go into is that John doesn't shows respect and gets respect back. I mean, there are countless evidence throughout the movie that he is shown respect. He doesn't kill just for the sake of killing. Meaning, if he gets information as he goes along, he doesn't just plainly kill them. He'll let the person just walk, you know, just take the night off, just go home, relax. And, but he's also feared, he's respected, you know, and the mob boss tells him, like, tells his son, he's like, "I'm gonna miss you when you're dead." And the guy is like, "No, I'm not gonna die, I'll kill John first." And, the mob boss tells his son, "Listen, you don't understand, the dude is, let me see here, it's like, that's the other page. He says that John Wick is pretty much Baba Yaga, aka Russian for boogeyman. And he's like, I ain't afraid of the boogeyman. He said, you don't understand. John is the one that we sent to kill the boogeyman, which means I'm afraid of John. The boogeyman is afraid of John. We're all afraid of John. He said, let me give you a reason why we're afraid of this man. He's focused. He knows what he's doing. He said, when I first met, and the mob boss says, I first met John in a bar. And this man killed, and John killed three men with a pencil in a bar. One pencil in a bar. And that's when the son goes, hush, shit. So, and, I mean, all in all, I'm not going to go into what happens, but John tells the mob boss, and he goes, and this is part of the speech, too, that seems to come as a statement from him as an actor, Keanu Reeves, and an actor that I'm backed, I'm meaning business this time, and I'm not going to try to do all these stupid little surfer dude movies. I'm going to try to do serious stuff now, but he tells the mob boss that when he got, it's not just a dog being a dog. He's saying that when he got the dog was the last gift from his wife, and he accepted the fact that he was transferring the love of his wife to the dog, so the dog in essence became his wife, and that her life was extended through the dog. So therefore, when his son, the mob boss's son, killed the dog, the son, in essence, killed John's wife. And that's how he puts it. It's like, it's not the sickness that killed my wife, it's your son that killed my wife. Because with the dog is was helping me heal. And extending my wife's life, in a way. In a way, you can all, almost psychologically was, you know, true. But I'm not going to, you know, tell you how it ends. But whether or not there's going to be two sequels, you figure it out. Like I said, this movie gets a hard 8.5. And it's one of the most semi-realistic out of this whole type of action movie genre, because it's like, it's not the hero that, even though John Wick is an anti-hero, he doesn't heal instantly like you see in a lot of these other movies, that they get hit with a bullet and the next scene the bullet wounds instantly healed. He does run out of ammo, he does use weapons on. He searches for weapons. He runs out of ammo. He uses what he finds. So there's a little bit of realism to this. And I do recommend it, especially if you like mob films. Even though this isn't really a mob film. Do give it at least a once watch. And also, that's it for this episode. I'm almost up to an hour. Wow. Great going, Audacity. We learned a couple, because I'll post this as soon as I'm done. Our homework today was a little bit of a failure. We learned about background noise, folks. Hopefully a lot of the environments that we'll be recording in are way quieter. Therefore, you'll hear me and the co-hosts much better and much louder. So, another thing I want to announce is that from a friend who upgraded his phone to a brand new AT&T Android phone, I got his old Android burn phone off of him for a couple of bucks, which it's a Net 10 type phone, which means I could pay on the month if I so wish. That phone, because it's an Android phone, I'm able to use Instagram now, so that'll be added to our lineup when I get that signed up. It's okay, approaching 35G. It's that whole aspect of a brand new phone that I can use for to upgrade. If we go to a show, I'm able to take Instagram, and you guys will be able to follow that. So that's always great. Live updates on Facebook and so forth. All that will be posted in the show notes. We are attempting to go to Stitcher as well. So, well, if this gets approved through Stitcher, welcome Stitcher listeners. Happy to have you on board. Again, great. Hope to speak to you guys again more. Maybe one or two more beta episodes prior to the official recording. See you next recording. Again, email us what you want to hear. If you want to hear more of this type of discussion, individual reviews, what you would like it to be called. Email us or on Facebook, tell us what you think about the season, the show opener, what you think about the closer. Feel free to email us. All that's in the show notes. But quickly, our email address, I'll give that to you. Right now, it's longcoatmafia@gmail.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Thank you for listening. I'm out.
It's shocking, humiliating, and it's unacceptable.
Oh, come on, it's a classic. The only show in the world that gets better the more it's rerun.
Do I get a choice?
No! No!
Screw you guys. I'm going home.
Okay, people, move along. There's nothing to see here.